Airline Pilot Guy, episode number 33. Hello, you're listening to the Airline Pilot Guy show. I'm Captain Jeff, the host of the show, the Airline Pilot Guy. And I'm broadcasting live from Studio 1544 in the lovely Hilton Hotel in downtown Milwaukee, Wisconsin. A very, very hot Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So we invite you to sit back, relax, make sure your seatbelts are fastened, and turn off those electronic... No, don't turn off your electronic device. You need to have those on to listen to the show. Sit back and relax. We'll be pushing back for Airline Pilot Guy, Flight 33, very shortly. Like, how about right now? Hey, you may have heard of this last week. A United Boeing 737 near Lake Charles encountered some turbulence. They had 76 passengers and 5 crew. They were climbing through flight level 280, which is about 28,000 feet above the ground, about 50 nautical miles southwest of Lake Charles, Louisiana, just crossing the coast towards the Gulf of Mexico. And let's see, it was 2021 local, so about 8:20 in the evening, getting a little bit dark, when the aircraft encountered severe turbulence that caused one flight attendant to receive serious and 2 flight attendants to receive minor injuries. The aircraft diverted to Lake Charles for a safe landing on Lake Charles runway 33, about 16 minutes later, the 3 crew members were taken to a hospital. And I was looking at this report on the Aviation Herald. That's avherald.com. And they have the radar plot and also the infrared satellite image of the weather at the time. And it looks like they caught a little bit of... a system, probably a convective system. Doesn't look too bad, actually. But, you know, it's getting dark. That's one of the things, one of the perils of our job. When we're flying and it starts, the visibility is kind of getting not so great because the light, available light, is diminishing. Sometimes it's hard to see things, and we rely more and more, especially when it gets pitch black, on our radar. And guess what? Things don't always show up on radar. And so they probably didn't see the area they were about to fly through, but they hit some pretty good turbulence and injured some flight attendants. Now, the point I want to make here about this is that apparently they still had the seatbelt light on because only flight attendants received injuries, which seems to indicate to me that all the passengers were in their seats. Now, each company is different. The company that I fly for, Acme Airlines, we have a policy that... basically, when we go through 10,000 feet, we actuate the no smoking signal, and that isn't, so we hear 2 bells, and that is the signal to the flight attendants that we're climbing through 10,000 feet, and it's okay for the passengers to turn on their electronic devices. Now, at Acme, it's kind of an well, I think it might be written policy, but I'm not positive. But I think that that's usually an indication to the flight attendants that it's okay to get up and start preparing the beverage carts and that kind of thing, and maybe even start the beverage service. And I just want you guys out there, guys and gals who are professional pilots flying for the airlines, to remember that if there's something that you think that the seatbelt or they should be seated for, you may want to, give them a quick call on their interphone and say, "Hey, look, we're going through 10,000 feet. I'm going to do the double ding thing, but I want you to stay in your seats until we're through this area, or I'll give you a call when it's okay to get up," or even make a PA in that regard. So now they may have done that. I don't know. A lot of times I'll say something to our flight attendants, and they'll ignore me and do whatever they want, which is not a good thing. I mean, I'm always concerned for the safety of everybody on board the airplane, including the flight attendant crew. And sometimes they think that they can encounter or weather through, severe turbulence or bad turbulence more so than passengers can. And it's not always the case. So anyway, I thought I'd point out that this is the time of year where we're starting to see a lot of turbulence injuries, and that just so happens to be the number one injury, other than, the number accounts for more injuries than anything else, turbulence does. So you, the passenger, make sure that unless you just need to get up and use the bathroom or whatever, don't get up out of your seat and walk around for no reason. If you're in your seat, make sure your seatbelt's on. And don't, make the seatbelt so loose that, you have 2 or 3 feet of space between you and the seatbelt. Of course, I don't think they're that big, but you know what I mean. You know, make sure it's nice and snug against you, just in case you encounter something unexpected like that turbulent air, or even maybe the autopilot kind of acting up. That's happened several times in history, and I've talked about that on our show and previous shows. And when that happens, you're going to go flying if you're not buckled in. All right, here, an update on that. Remember that JetBlue flight, that captain, that kind of went berserk, and somehow the co-pilot, or maybe the captain, decided upon himself or on his own to leave the cockpit. But when he did, the co-pilot basically locked him out, wouldn't let him back in, and they diverted into Amarillo, Texas. You remember, I think it's in the news right now, in fact, that I think the lawyers and such decided, or the judge determined, that he was fit for trial. And so that trial is either starting right now or just about to start. But in regard to that, 10 passengers filed a lawsuit last week against JetBlue Airways, claiming they feared for their lives when a pilot had to be physically restrained after running through the cabin yelling about Jesus and Al-Qaeda during a New York to Las Vegas flight in March. And the lawsuit filed in the Supreme Court in Queens claims the airline was grossly negligent in allowing Captain Clayton Osman to fly. Now, here, I have a question for you. How was the airline grossly negligent in allowing a guy who has all the requirements to be an airline pilot, all the experience, and he has a medical certificate that that certifies that he's medically, both physically and mentally, certified to fly a Part 121 carrier. Thank you. So unless there was something that they knew about this captain that indicated that he was kind of a little bit imbalanced, maybe they did. I don't know. I'm not saying they didn't, but it just seems to me that this is just being opportunistic, and people are just wanting money because they happen to experience a bad, or have a bad experience on board a flight. Yeah, I know. I understand. You were very scared. I would be too if I saw the captain running through the cabin and screaming about Al-Qaeda and terrorism and all that kind of stuff. But sometimes things happen. So we'll see what happens with that lawsuit. How do you feel about that? Send me some feedback. Here's an interesting one. A Danish air transport, McDonnell Douglas MD-83, performing flight 3098 from Kabul, Afghanistan to Trabzon, Turkey, and then further to Copenhagen, Denmark, with 90 passengers and 5 crew, was en route at flight level 310, about 60 nautical miles northeast of Turkmenistan, when the crew agreed the captain would take a rest. The first officer took control of the aircraft. The captain leaned back and closed his eyes. Shortly after the captain's body suffered violent convulsions, causing the body to form a backward arc, and his feet were repeatedly thrown onto the floor. These convulsions also resulted in the captain's head hitting cockpit panels, resulting in injuries to his head. Then the convulsions ceased, and the captain's body collapsed. The first officer tried to contact the captain, but received no response. The purser came to the cockpit to assist with the removal of the captain from the flight deck, as the first officer was concerned further convulsions might result in the captain hitting flight controls or switches. After verifying that the captain was alive but unconscious, the purser and the first officer agreed the captain needed medical treatment as soon as possible. The first officer decided to divert to Ashgabat, Turkmenistan, and request medical assistance for the captain upon arrival. The air traffic control, however, had trouble understanding what the first officer was requesting, but then finally cleared the flight to descend and head towards the airport. A doctor on board was called out and found amongst the passengers. She checked the captain and, while in the cabin, while she was checking the captain, she noticed that he was beginning to become conscious again. The captain, however, was confused. He could not remember his name, his age, or what had happened. The doctor could not find anything besides high blood pressure and a wound on his head. During the descent, the captain became more and more conscious and wanted to return to the cockpit, not understanding why they diverted to Ashgabat. The purser prevented the captain from entering the cockpit again. The captain, however, insisted and finally entered the cockpit and took a seat. Okay, now I'm going to put this on pause. I don't know how he got back in to the cockpit without somebody opening the door for him. So apparently he convinced the co-pilot and or the purser to open up the cockpit door and let him back in, which is a big no-no. At Acme Airlines, if somebody is incapacitated, that's it. They don't touch the controls again, no matter how much they protest. Like the JetBlue captain, they got him out of the cockpit and they said, nope, you're not getting back into the cockpit and have access to controls. Anyway, let's see. The aircraft touched down safely in Ashgabat with the first officer still... Oh, wait a minute. I'm sorry. I skipped over here. Let me back up a little bit. So the captain came in to the cockpit, took a seat. The first officer explained what had happened and convinced the captain to let him continue flying without interference. That's good. The aircraft touched down safely in Ashgabat with the first officer still at the controls. During rollout, the first officer felt confident enough to invite the captain to take control and steer the aircraft to the parking apron, as he was sure he could stop the aircraft via the brake pedal anytime if necessary. In other words, the first officer thought, okay, I'm going to let the captain taxi the airplane, and if I think that something's going weird, I can use the brakes on my side to stop the aircraft. When the aircraft turned onto taxiway Delta, the first officer felt the speed was too high and stopped the aircraft with his brake pedals. The captain insisted he had control of the aircraft, but the first officer was not inclined to let him continue steering the aircraft, but again, considering he always could stop the aircraft this wording is a little weird. So it sounds to me like he again allowed the captain to proceed with taxiing the airplane. The captain managed to turn the aircraft 90 degrees off onto the taxiway and steer the aircraft guided by a follow-me vehicle to the parking stand. After the aircraft stopped at the stand, a waiting medical team entered the aircraft. The captain, however, refused to be taken to a hospital, claiming he was okay. The first officer and flight attendant managed to persuade the captain, however, to be taken to the hospital. The flight attendant went to the hospital with him. So that's what we have regarding that. I don't know if there are any updates about that, but... Anyway, it looks like he suffered a generalized seizure, and which the HCL, the Danish Havarikommission, I'm not sure what that means, maybe their FAA, maybe? They released a report in Danish saying that, okay, here we go. The captain suffered a generalized seizure and an event that was not necessarily included in flight crew training. And the event consisted of three elements, each of which placed great demand on the first officer. Violent and uncontrolled movements of the captain near the flight controls. Yeah, that's not good. Lack of awareness by the captain, and the captain's inability to comprehend what had happened and his inability to understand he was unfit to continue duties. And so anyway, the first officer did a great job. However, my only critique here is that I would not have allowed the captain to come back into the cockpit. No matter how much he protested, I would have declared the emergency as he did and land the aircraft, pull off the runway as best as you can because it's kind of hard to steer an airplane if you're not in the captain's seat. Now, some airplanes have steering tillers on both sides of the cockpit, but most airplanes don't. The tiller that we use for nose wheel steering for turns more than 6 to 7 degrees, like a big 90-degree turn, that's all on the captain's side in most airplanes. And so, he could probably clear the runway and just stop and have medical assistance or take care of the situation. But anyway, this is going to be probably something that we see more and more as, we in the United States, the FAA has passed the law several years now that we can fly until we're 65 years old, as long as we have a medical certificate that deems that we're, fit to fly. But, the workforce is getting older out there, and we're going to most likely see more and more episodes like this. And that's why it's even more important that we have more than one person in the cockpit, right? We have at least two people up there in case somebody has an episode and they are incapacitated. Okay, well, I spent more on that than I wanted to. I saw this on, AOL.com. Who's really flying your airplane? From AOL Travel News. Aircraft are some of the most sophisticated machines in the world, with computer systems so advanced that the planes could seemingly fly themselves. So just how much of what goes on during a commercial flight, how much of it is automated by a computer? Perhaps more than you think. And you know what? I don't agree. I think most passengers think that about 90 to 100% of the time the airplane is being flown by the automatic flight system. Here it says, about 75 to 80% of the flight is done using the autopilot in conjunction with the flight management system, says Kevin Hyatt of Alexandria, Virginia, the former pilot for Delta Airlines. He works for, he's the executive vice president of the Flight Safety Foundation. The flight management system, or FMS, automates many in-flight tasks, taking much of the workload off pilots. Autopilots keep the heading and altitude steady, he explains. Along with the autopilot, there are auto throttles connected to the FMS. Not all airplanes, by the way, but most. Certain performance numbers are put into the flight management computer, and by engaging all those at the same time, the airplane can descend, climb, and cruise more efficiently. And I would agree with that. And while hand flying, which is pilot speak for when the airplane's controls are actually being manipulated by the pilot, still takes place during takeoffs and good weather landings, it's the autopilot that's flying the plane for the bulk of the flights. Yes, and I agree with that, because most of it is kind of monotonous stuff. And, toward the when you're in the climb and cruise aspects of the flight and initial descent, it's a good idea to have the auto flight system hooked up, because it does a pretty good job of flying smoothly and efficiently. But this is why I wanted to read this article to you, this quote. And I don't know, it made me really ponder some things. Here's the quote. Airlines have their own rules as to when an autopilot can be switched on, but it's usually around an altitude of 1,000 feet. This is standard operating procedure on airlines across the board, whether pilots are flying a 777 or a regional jet. That's definitely a good thing, says Karen Kahn, a longtime captain with one of the major U.S. legacy carriers, since the autopilot provides passengers with a smoother ride. An airplane is so much more touchy when it's not on autopilot, says Kahn. It needs continual corrections, and you can feel the difference. It's as if you're on a balancing on a ball and continually having to stay balanced, as opposed to having something fixed to hold on to, she says. Now, the reason why it caused me to ponder a little bit, and maybe that's why a lot of the people that I fly with like to get the autopilot on as quickly as possible, because it does take some skill to fly or hand fly the airplane smoothly. And that's one of the things that I've always, that's always been my goal. It's always been something that I feel is part of my craft, to be able to fly the airplane as smoothly as I can by hand flying the airplane. And, some of us can do it. I remember some great captains I used to fly with that were hand flying the airplane, and I could swear that the autopilot was engaged, because it was just so darn rock solid smooth. And I think that there are pilots out there, and I've flown with many of them, that aren't very confident about their skills, and so they'll slap that autopilot system on as soon as they can. And with ACME, the soonest that we can engage the autopilot is 500 feet above the ground, but that varies depending on the airline for which you fly. But and that's the reason why. Actually, the opposite of the point she's making is the reason why sometimes I like to hand fly the airplane, because depending on your airplane, now remember, I'm talking about the McDonnell Douglas 80 series and the flight management system installed on this airplane at ACME Airlines. When certain modes of flight, especially in the descent, I had an episode today where the autopilot just kind of decided that it was going to do a tremendous nose over and dive, very uncomfortable, and you know, it was startling, in fact, and I had to change autopilot modes to kind of recover the airplane and go from, you know, I think the thing was about 4 to 5,000 feet per minute descending, and I was able to get it under control and get it comfortable again. But sometimes hand flying the airplane, there is not going to be a surprise. So that's all I'm saying about that. But in general, that is true. The autopilot systems are very good at flying smoothly and efficiently and safely. But we just always have to be monitoring what the autopilot system is doing, just in case something goes awry, as it did today with me. Okay, so that's that article. Now I'm going to do something right now, an article that I've been meaning to talk about the last two episodes, but somehow I always run out of time. And I thought it was interesting. And these apply to those of us who do a lot of traveling. And the name of the article is Top 10 Travel Apps, and I found this on hotelscheap.org. If you haven't used travel apps on your smartphone, you're missing out. Travel apps have revolutionized travel. Gone are the days of printing an itinerary or calling the airline to find out what gate your flight's departing from. You can even use travel apps to find the nearest public restroom and see how clean it is on your phone ahead of time. Below is the list of the top 10 must-have travel apps. Once you try these, you'll be hooked. Now, many of these I've used myself and have on my phone, my iPhone. Some I have not tried yet, so my intent is to download them and give them a whirl myself. And then some, of course, are I just don't see how it would be useful to me at all. But let's start out by looking at the number one. Or should I? Maybe I should start from number 10, kind of do a top 10 list. So I'm going to go scroll all the way to the bottom of this article, and number 10, Trip Journal. It's a travel journaling app. You know, I talked about on one of the last shows about how important keeping a logbook is, and I'm not setting a very good example with that because I don't keep my my own personal logbook. In fact, the show, in a way, is kind of my own journal, remembering or recounting things that have happened to me in the past while flying. But I should still do it, though, so maybe I'll take a look at this. But it's a journaling app. And it tracks the exact travel route with your phone's GPS system and adds geotagging to all your photos. Okay, lets you add place marks and notes, gathers information on distances covered, can export your route to Google Earth with photographs embedded in the route. Now that's kind of cool. That kind of sounds like a geocaching kind of thing. Anyway, it's $2.99, so this one's not free. I think most of these are free, but this one is $2.99. It's called Trip Journal. That's number 10. Number 9, this is an interesting one. I'm not sure I would use this one, but perhaps more for the female members of our audience. Sit or Squat. Yes, all one word, Sit or Squat. Public Bathroom Locator. It has a current working database of over 100,000 toilets. It separates listings into either sit or squat based on comfort and cleanliness, and returns results based on the geolocation information. And that's free. So ladies or guys, if you want to see how clean and suitable bathrooms are. You can download Sit or Squat. Number 8, Yelp. Yelp is a rating and review app, and many of you are familiar with Yelp. I use it quite often to look for reviews for restaurants, and you can look for reviews for hotels, restaurants, and attractions. And it says it has you covered in travel emergencies, too. I guess it has a list of dentists, doctors, and pharmacies. Uses current location to find the nearest results. Monocle feature superimposes business names onto buildings in camera's view. Well, that's kind of cool. That's a free app, Yelp. Check that out. I have that one, by the way, on my phone. Here's a good one if you go to big cities and you travel via public transportation, called All Subway, A-L-L-S-U-B-W-A-Y, All Subway. That's a subway map and route planner. Comes with subway maps for 137 cities and does not require internet connectivity, which is really important, especially if you're in the subway and you have no signal and you need to figure out what stop to get off the train. It's nice to be able to do that without having internet connectivity. And that is 99 cents. All Subway. Okay, number 6. This is a good one. Kayak. I recommend this service to a lot of people out there traveling and buying tickets. That's Kayak, like the boat in the water, K-A-Y-A-K. It's a free app. It's a comprehensive flight, hotel, and car rental booking agent, and it has a packing list feature that makes sure you never forget your toothbrush. Boy, I could have used that in the last couple of trips. It can track your flight, convert currency, locate local attractions, and provides price alerts, and it's free. It's a great way to find the cheapest ticket. And just be aware, though, usually the cheapest ticket is one that's going to take you through all kinds of stops and probably have long layovers in airports that are off the beaten track and such. So you might want to pay attention when you're using some of these travel services that a flight from Atlanta to Los Angeles doesn't take you 15 hours because you've gone from Atlanta to Tampa to New York to Los Angeles. But it's probably the cheapest way to go, but it's going to take you all darn day. Okay, number 5, Trailhead, T-R-A-I-L-H-E-A-D. The North Face's Outdoor Activity Finder uses your location and lists all hiking trails and bike paths in close proximity. It can also track your speed, route, distance, and elevation, and lead you to the nearest North Face store. Okay, so that's a commercial app by North Face. It's free, and it's called Trailhead. So if you are a hiker, it might be kind of handy. Here's one I have on my phone, and honestly, I have not used it. I keep forgetting I have it, and I should try to remember to do that. It's called Postagram, P-O-S-T-A-G-R-A-M, Postagram. It's a postcard delivery app. You can take a photo with the app and type in an address, a snail mail address, and then a Postagram will print out a postcard and mail it to the address provided. This is a free app, and then each postcard you send, each delivered postcard, is 99 cents. That's a pretty good deal, I think. Let's see, I think that the latest OS, iOS, has that kind of capability built in, or at least they have some kind of an app that allows you to do that, but I don't think it's as cheap as 99 cents per delivered postcard. I think it's more than that. I've not used it. I will do that soon, and I'll give you my review on Postagram. That's kind of fun. You know, a lot of us have forgotten that that used to be the way we communicated with people, not electronically, but by the good old-fashioned mail service. Okay, number 3, FlightAware, F-L-I-G-H-T-A-W-A-R-E, FlightAware. And as you know, I use that every day on my computers and just about every day on my iPhone. It's a flight tracker app. It's easy to use. Just provide your flight number and gives you push notifications if you want to keep you up to date with delays, gate changes, and cancellations. It's a free app, and I go to flightaware.com, as I said, at least a couple times a day to look at news items and such. And use it to track flights, and it's pretty accurate too. It's amazing. Sometimes I'll look at the route of flight that they've posted on there, and it's identical to our actual file. I guess they must pull that information from an FAA database, and it's like exactly our route of flight, you know, our departure SID, our all the fixes and jet routes, Victor routes, that kind of thing, arrival, standard instrument arrival procedures, etc. Very, very accurate and great app. I use it all the time. Number two, Wikitude, Augmented Reality Travel Guide. Now, I do not have this one. I'd like to give this one a whirl as well. It overlays Wikipedia and user-generated content on your phone's camera. So you point your camera at a landmark and you get information about the landmark. It uses your phone's GPS, compass, and movement sensors. And it's free. Wikitude. I like that. I'll have to give that a try. And the number one top 10 travel app. Number one, TripIt. TRIPIT. It's a travel organizer, and it links your email account and collates, or links with your email account and collates all confirmation numbers into one location. Hotel, flight, dinner reservations, etc. Book restaurants, buy tickets, search attractions with TripIt. It provides maps, directions, weather, and it's free. I do have TripIt. I don't use it. If I were traveling as a business person out there and doing a lot of the bookings for hotels and flights and that kind of thing myself, I'd probably use it all the time. But I don't, because as you may know, and I've mentioned before, with Acme, all the accommodations are taken care of by my company, and all the transportation to and from the airport is all taken care of for us. So I never have to worry about those type of details. But anyway, do you have a favorite travel app? If you do, or if you've used any of these and you think they're good or bad, or you have a better choice than the ones that they came up with, send me feedback at feedback@airlinepilotguy.com. Call my voicemail line, my Google Voice number, 304-99-PILOT, 304-997-4568, or go to the Airline Pilot Guy website, that's airlinepilotguy.com, and click on the little SpeakPipe send voicemail tab. And yeah, so that's all I have to say about travel apps. Oh, you know what? I have one more thing to say. One that I use every trip, and it's another app like FlightAware that is a flight tracker application and gives you gate information and that kind of thing. And it's called Flight Tracker Pro, and it's not free. It's, I think it was like $10. But I go through and put all the flights in my trip, my rotation, and I enter them in, and it is usually more accurate than looking on those darn screens at the airport. It seems like, for some reason, this travel app, Flight Tracker Pro, seems to know when a gate change takes place before my company does. It's weird. Anyway, so that's the one that I use that's not on the list, but probably not on the list because it's not cheap. It's $10. But I highly recommend it, Flight Tracker Pro. By the way, if any of you out there want to advertise on my show, contact me. Just go to feedback@airlinepilotguy.com. And, if you want to advertise something related to flying or some kind of pilot gear like headsets, etc., contact me and we can work some kind of deal. I'd be happy to do that as long as it was something that I believed in. Let's see here. Let's get back to my list of things to talk about. Here's something else that I saw that I thought might be interesting to talk about. It's called 50 Secrets Pilots Won't Tell You. It's from Reader's Digest back in November of 2010. Why I'm seeing it right now, I have no idea. But anyway, I'll just read a few of these things because it's kind of a long article. It's not all glamour up in the air. When you get on an airplane at 7 a.m. and you want your pilot to be rested and ready, but the hotels they put us in are so bad that there are many nights when I toss and turn. They're in bad neighborhoods, they're loud, they've got bed bugs, there have been stabbings in the parking lot. Okay, this is quoting a guy, Jack, Apparently Jack doesn't work for my airline, because that is not true at all. I think Acme does a wonderful job in putting us up in very nice hotels and in safe areas and no bed bug. In fact, our Buffalo layover, I hear, was moved to a different hotel because there were many, many reports of bed bugs. And I think, I talked about that on a previous episode. And so my company takes good care of its crews, so I'm very pleased about that. Let's see, those buddy passes they give us, I give them only to my enemies now. Sure, you can get $1,000 airfare to Seattle for $100, but since you have to fly standby, it will take you 3 months to get back because you can't get a seat. Now, that one I do agree with. You know, we used to get these, well, we've had these for a while now, buddy passes. And it used to be that it was a pretty good deal. You could save some money, especially international travel. And you could be reasonably assured that you would get a seat on an airplane, or at least, you know, pick two or three flights and catch one of them. But nowadays, with the efficiency of reservation systems and computers and load management systems and everything else, it's very, very difficult to get a seat on an airplane traveling on standby. And remember, when you're using those buddy passes, that's the lowest travel priority of any of the standby levels. At Acme, we have S1, which is basically almost positive space travel, usually in an emergency and that kind of thing. S2, which is the priority that we can use a few times a year for what we used to call vacation passes. It gives you a little bit higher priority. S3 is the normal priority for employees and their families. S3B, so like a half priority down from that, is the category of travel for my parents and, retired employees. And then finally, the last category, S4, at the bottom of the pile are the buddy pass people. And I'll tell you what, these days, it's a tough way to travel. And the point about giving them only to your enemies is pretty accurate. It's a lot of risk that you take as far as, you know, making sure you're going to get on a flight. And you better be very flexible with your travel plans. That's all I can say. Okay, I'll just read one more, and then I'll try to remember to read a few of these on every show. Cold on the airplane? Tell your flight attendant. We're in a constant battle with them over the temperature. They're moving all the time, up and down the aisles, so they are always calling and saying, turn up the air. But most passengers I know are freezing. And that's from a captain in a major carrier. And in most of our airplanes, we have control of the temperature of the cabin. And he's right. You know, when the flight attendants are back there working and pushing carts and everything else, they start warming up, and some of our flight attendants are a little bit older, and their hormones are, you know, changing, and sometimes they have hot flashes and that kind of thing. And so we have to be very careful sometimes when they call up and tell us to turn down the air conditioning system, because we, you know, have a little gauge up there that shows us the temperature of the cabin, and we're thinking, well, it should be okay. The gauge is not always accurate, though, so I wish there was a way to know exactly, you know, how the passengers feel, but it's interesting. Usually, right away, we're asked to turn up the heat because it's too cold, and then about halfway through the flight, we're asked to cool it off, and that's because the flight attendants have been up on their feet working, you know, doing the beverage service and meal service and that type of thing. Okay, one more thing. Okay, this is from Joe Dionne. He used to have a podcast entitled Fly With Me. I think it was called Fly With Me. And he says, I always tell my kids to travel in sturdy shoes. If you have to evacuate and your flip-flops fall off, there you are standing on the hot tarmac or in the weeds in your bare feet. Yeah, not to mention the fact that if you're in a really bad situation and there are things burning, you don't want to be barefoot or in flip-flops. Good advice. Make sure you have some reasonable shoes and sturdy travel shoes. Okay, that's it for 50 secrets pilots won't tell you. And I'm telling you, because they're not really secrets. Let's do some feedback.
Captain Jeff. It's Jen, the Lutheran pastor's wife. I'm at Ontario International Airport, gate 403, doing circles, trying to play tire out the three-year-old. Just calling with some tips on flying with kids. If your kid is over the age of two, I recommend having your laptop, having it your Wi-Fi turned off, and having some kind of DVD, as that will keep your kid quiet and hopefully put them to sleep. Never be afraid to ask for help going through security if you need it. Some airports have a family line, and if you're nice like Ontario Airport is, you can actually take the crew line once you've got a stroller. And above all, if everything fails and you're a mom traveling with a small child, start crying. People rush to help you when that happens. God bless. Bye-bye.
That's not fair. Crying. The old crying straw. I guess that's good advice. Good advice for traveling with young ones. Thanks, Jen, for your feedback. Let's see. Armando sent me some feedback, and let's listen to what Armando has to say.
Hey, Captain Jeff. This is Armando from the big state of Texas. I have two questions for you. First one is, I don't know if you saw the movie Passenger 57 with Wesley Snipes. It's an old 90s movie. If that one is the L-1011 aircraft that they use in the movie, and I'm basing it on your latest podcast that has the little elevator going up and down the to the service galley below. And secondly, I've always had a curiosity on why pilots have to wear short sleeve shirts. Is it because a long sleeve shirt could accidentally trigger or toggle a switch on the center console while you're performing your duties? Anyway, thank you very much for the podcast. I sincerely enjoy it, and I hope you have a good day. Bye.
Well, thanks for your feedback, Armando, and that was really nice. He used his smartphone voice memo app to send that in. That sounded great. Okay, you mentioned Passenger 57 back in the 90s. You know, the 90s don't seem that long ago to me. And I looked at the trailer to this movie with Wesley Snipes, Passenger 57. I don't think I saw the movie myself. Maybe I did. Maybe I just don't remember. But I'm always amazed at how movies made in the 90s look like they were made in the 60s. It just looks really, really old and kind of cheesy. But I guess we've come a long way in our movie-making magic. But this is the soundtrack to the movie Passenger 57. Yes, that you are correct. That was an L-1011 that they used for the location, the set of the movie. And I mentioned I talked about flying the L-1011 on my last episode. Great airplane, and yep, good eye. It has elevators that go to the lower galley on some of the models, and so that answers that question. The other question you have is kind of I kind of chuckled when you asked it, because you said, you know, why are we required to wear short sleeve shirts? And the reason why Armando is saying that is because his experience is that most of the time he sees pilots, when they're not wearing their coats, they have short sleeve shirts on. And the only time I'm required to wear a short sleeve shirt is when we have our summer uniform, which is basically March through October, I believe. And when we wear the summer uniform, which is an option, you know, we don't have to. We can wear our coat year round if we want to. But this time of year, with the temperatures out there, it's not very comfortable to be wearing the uniform jacket. But if you decide to do the summer uniform option, you have to wear short sleeve shirts. At Acme, they do not want us to wear the long sleeve if we don't wear our coat. I don't know why. I guess they think it doesn't look right. That's just at Acme. A lot of other airlines, in fact, I saw a couple of American Airline guys yesterday waiting for a hotel van, and I think both of them were wearing long sleeve shirts, and neither of them were wearing their coats. And so going back to the non-summer uniform at Acme, when we have to wear our uniform coat or uniform jacket, again, it's not a requirement to wear short sleeve or long sleeve. Most, I'd say probably 95% of pilots at ACME wear short sleeve shirts. And I think that there are a couple of reasons for this. Probably it's just easier that way because year round, all you have to do is wear the same shirt. Not the actually same shirt, but you know, that style of shirt. So when you go buy new shirts, you just buy short sleeve shirts. They're a little bit cheaper. You can wear them for more than one day at a time because when you wear a long sleeve shirt, the sleeves, airplane cockpits are not clean. They're workplaces and they get dirty. And I'll note, I like to wear long sleeve shirts in the wintertime. I'll notice that I'm getting pretty grungy looking cuffs and sleeves, you know, where I'm getting close to touching controls and that kind of thing. I don't know. Does it cost more to dry clean a long sleeve shirt? I don't think so. My dry cleaners, I think it's the same cost. But if you do your own shirt, launder your own shirts and iron your own shirts, short sleeve shirts are easier to iron than long sleeve shirts. It's interesting. When I was hired by ACME, again, about 23 years ago, a little bit more than that, I asked my good friend who had been flying for ACME for several years, when it was time for us to order our uniform items, I said, "Hey, Ken, you know, how many short sleeve and how many long sleeve shirts should I buy?" And he said, "Oh, nobody wears long sleeve shirts at ACME. Just buy short sleeve." I went, "Okay." And then I thought to myself, you know, I've always been the kind of guy that wants to kind of buck the trend and do things differently. So I ordered mostly short sleeve shirts, but I did order a couple long sleeve shirts. And I'm glad I did because, as I said, now when it's that time of year when I'm wearing the uniform coat, I like to wear the long sleeve shirt. It keeps me warmer in those colder times of year. And I think it looks better. I think it looks more professional. So I hope that answers your question, Armando. We're not required to. It has nothing to do with safety, at least with my company. It's just more to do with convenience and maybe comfort for a lot of guys. And we're cheap, right? So I don't know. Those of you out there flying for the airlines, why don't you chime in? What do you think? I again, as I say, I like wearing long sleeve shirts. I think it looks just looks better with the uniform coat. All right, and one more piece of voice feedback, this time from Hillel.
Greetings, Captain Jeff. This is Hillel. I was just listening to Airline Pilot Guy episode 32 and had a fun story myself about a headwind on a flight probably 20 years ago coming back from Paris to the U.S. I don't recall if it was IAD or JFK. The headwind was strong enough that it took us over 9 hours to get from Paris, I think it was Charles de Gaulle, to the east coast of the U.S., a flight that doesn't always take 9 hours or close to 10 hours in this case. Typically, that flight, as you probably know, is more on the order of 7, maybe 8 hours, but well over 9, closer to 10 hours. I know, in fact, I think my memory is faulty. I think it was 11 hours. It was really very, very long because I've flown even further. I've flown to the Middle East several times. Dozens of times, and I know that sometimes the Middle East, all the way from, say, example, Tel Aviv or Cairo to the East Coast, is an 11-hour flight if you've got light winds. So to get from Paris, which is almost 3,000 miles closer, to the East Coast in more than 10 hours, that's a long flight. If you do the math using Newtonian physics, the Earth was probably rotating underneath us. And that's how we got from Paris to the East Coast. If you think of the aircraft suspended in the atmosphere and simply rotating the Earth under us, was about as long as it took for us to get from Paris to the East Coast. It would have, from an observer, a stationary observer in space, it certainly would have seemed like the plane was standing still and the Earth was rotating, and that's how strong the wind, as though there was almost, you know, no forward motion at all, just enough power to keep us in the air. And and not going backwards. And as far as I know, we could have been going backwards. But anyway, it was a very, very strong headwind, and I just wanted to share that. It was that mathematically it made for a good story. Well, keep up the great work. Great seeing you online, and the stories are always awesome, and I look forward to future episodes. Be clear and unlimited. Take care. Bye-bye.
Well, of course, an elementary explanation using Newtonian physics. I mean, come on. This audience is so much more sophisticated than that, Hillel. I mean, that reminds me, here's someone trying to explain the concept in a little bit more precise way, I think.
Now, basically, the only new principle involved is that instead of power being generated by the relative motion of conductors and fluxes, it is produced by the modal interaction of magnetoreluctance and capacitive directance. The original machine had a base plate of prefamulated amulite surmounted by a malleable logarithmic casing in such a way that the two spurving bearings were in a direct line with a panometric fam. The latter consisted simply of six hydrocoptic marzal vanes so fitted to the ambifacient lunar wane shaft that side fumbling was effectively prevented. The main winding was of the normal Lotus O-Delta type placed in panendermic semi-boloid slots of the stator. Every seventh...
You know, I don't want to bore you with these elementary, simplistic explanations of Newtonian physics. So we'll just move on. Hope you enjoyed that. Thanks for your feedback, Hillel. He was had his tongue inserted into his cheek and was having some fun with mathematical solutions to why it takes so much longer to get from Europe to the United States than it does going from the United States to Europe. And places beyond, I should say, not just Europe. All right, I also received some feedback from Ken. He's the ExpressJet pilot. Captain Jeff, hi, just finished listening to the latest show, and it was my plan to lay low from regular feedback for a while, but you had to mention the L-1011. Having grown up in a family of Eastern employees, it's always been one of my favorite planes, and non-revving on one back in the day was always a special event. Anyway, I just wanted to share an L-1011 story. I had the fortune of hearing about a year ago when an FAA guy was riding on my jump seat. We were working two legs back to Atlanta from Fort Lauderdale, and when we showed up at the gate, an FAA guy introduced himself as he checked our credentials. During our brief flight in Tallahassee, in Tallahassee, we started asking the Fed guy about his background, and it turns out he was a 30-year Eastern man full of good stories. He said he flew every plane they had, starting with the Convair and ending with his favorite, the 727. And like yourself, he also flew right seat in the L-1011. Looking back now, I wish our flight that day was longer, since he seemed full of good stories from his glory years at the once great airline. He proceeded to share with us an L-1011 story of the only close call he ever had. It was back in the late 70s. He was working a flight from Miami to New York. He couldn't recall whether it was LaGuardia or JFK. Probably JFK. And he said as they neared New York, the entire area was fogged in. The minimums were below standard Cat 1 mins, but due to a maintenance deferral, they could not shoot any Category 2 approaches, so they ended up diverting to Boston. He said he thought that they were done for the night, but the captain, who, by the way, was an instructor pilot, was a hard charger and determined to wait out the hourly weather reports until the crew timed out. Then, around 2 in the morning, a report came across showing a temporary line with minimums above Category 2. The captain got all excited and had the gate reload a full plane load of people, and soon they were off for another attempt at New York. But not long after takeoff, the weather turned again, and they found themselves over New York once more, unable to get in. The Fed guy told us he saw this coming, and launching again based on a single tempo line was probably not the wisest thing to do. But this captain was insistent, and not wanting to give up, he told his crew that the only thing preventing them from shooting a Category 2 approach was one simple circuit breaker on the spoiler system. He suggested they try pushing it in and give the approach a try, and so they did. Having reset the circuit breaker, everything appeared fine, so they asked ATC for vectors and began the approach. As they were coming up on the final fix, the glide slope came alive and final flaps and gear were called for. But then something unexpected happened. Just inside the final approach fix, the VSI, the vertical speed indicator, indicated an unusually high sync rate. They began adding power until finally reaching full power, but it still wasn't enough. They were sinking fast. He told us they owe their lives to the flight engineer that night, as he was the only one who noticed what was wrong. The flight spoilers had fully deployed, and when he called it out, they immediately disabled the system and recovered the airplane. On the recovery, the altimeters were only indicating 200 feet AGL, 200 above ground level. Looking back at it, he told us the only reason they didn't shoot Cat 2s that night was a simple flight spoiler deferral calling for one circuit breaker to be pulled. On any normal airplane, one might think, why would flight spoilers have anything to do with instrument approaches? But as you mentioned in your podcast, this airplane is different. When they reset the breaker, he said everything was fine because the spoiler system didn't activate until they were in the final configuration for landing. And since the system wasn't working properly, it set them up for a near disaster. While I'm not familiar with the systems of the L-1011, I'm guessing this all ties in with a little bit of insight on the landing spoilers you shared with us in this week's podcast. Yep, they're all part of the direct lift control system. Lastly, I remember the RB211 engines, Rolls-Royce RB211s. They always had those fancy Rolls-Royce stickers on the side, and for some reason, these engines always made a very distinctive sound, a sound I could always recognize from the ground before even looking up and knowing that there was an L-1011 flying overhead. The Fed guy told me these engines always seemed to have airflow issues, and hot starts were not all that uncommon. I was wondering if you ever noticed anything similar. Yes. Well, I'll answer that here in a minute. I'll finish with your email. Okay, one more thing. Among airline aficionados, you're either a fan of the L-1011 or the DC-10. Personally, I favor the L-1011, but I have a friend who swears up and down that the DC-10 was the better of the two planes. Debating which plane deserves the crown always makes for some fun and interesting comparisons. Sincerely, Ken Stringer, ExpressJet First Officer. Well, yes, the discussion versus L-1011 and DC-10, they're both three-engine wide-body airplanes carrying about the same passenger load. I think the DC-10 had the edge when it came to cargo-carrying capability. I have talked to some folks who have flown both airplanes because we bought Western Airlines back in the mid-80s, and Western had DC-10s, so as part of the merging of the two airlines, we ended up getting several DC-10s, and we were using them mostly for the LA-Hawaii runs. I think that if you were to be fair and you flew both airplanes, I think that most pilots would say that the L-1011 was a better flying airplane. It was more of an elegant experience, more polished. They'd probably say that the DC-10 had an edge in some areas of performance, such as cargo carrying capability in addition to passengers, and maybe some short field performance. The engines were different. As you mentioned, the L-1011 used the Rolls-Royce RB211s, and the DC-10, I think most of them used the Pratt & Whitney's. Maybe they used some GE's on that one. But you're right. I think that it's always fun to have that discussion with people. But I've never flown the DC-10, so I can't really vouch much for that one. But I can tell you this also, the MD-11, which is kind of an evolution of the DC-10, is still being flown by a lot of airlines out there. And, in fact, Acme flew them as well. It's experienced some problems with stability landing in high crosswinds especially. Now, anybody out there who has flown the DC-10 or MD-11, you might want to chime in and give us some information about that. But there have been several crashes of McDonnell Douglas MD-11s, mostly cargo carriers, apparently it just doesn't have very good characteristics when landing in very high winds. But that's all I can say about that. Now, the RB211 engines. This was an amazing engine that Rolls-Royce designed. It had most jet turbines out there, even the very high bypass engines, have two compressor sections. and two turbine sections. This airplane had a triple compressor and triple turbine section, so it was kind of a one-of-a-kind type of, I don't know if it's one-of-a-kind, but it was not very common. And you're right, it made a very, very distinctive sound. In fact, you could be two concourses over in Atlanta, and when a L-1011 was starting up the Rolls-Royce engines, you could hear it, because not only could you hear it, it was like a vibration, kind of like the guy or gal pulling up to you at a stoplight, and he's got that, you know, music, that bass really cranked up, and you can just feel it vibrating your own car, and you look around like, where is that coming from? That was the RB211 Rolls-Royce engine. You could hear it for probably a mile away. It just had this, not only that sound, but that vibration that was very distinctive. And it was a very, very long start process. I think it took almost 3 minutes from the time you engaged the starter to the time it was finally at idle power. Just a very, very long process. So much so that when I went from the L-1011 to the 727 to check out for the first time as a captain, when I was in the simulator and we were starting the engines on the 727, they started so quickly, I swung my head around very quickly and looked at the instructor and said, well, that's not right. I mean, that's just the simulator, right? These engines don't start that fast. And they said, oh, yeah, they do, Jeff. It's just been so long since you've been flying the 727, you've forgotten that most engines start that quickly. It's just the RB211s took forever. It was quite a quite an ordeal, and yes, they did have airflow problems and hot starts and that kind of thing. It was a full-time job getting those engines started, but once they were running, they were great engines. And thank you for relating that story that the Fed guy had with the spoiler system, and that just points out an issue there. You know, if a circuit breaker is pulled, there's probably a good reason for it, and we're not allowed to reset circuit breakers on our own prerogative because they can get you in trouble. So thanks for the feedback, Ken. Keep it coming. Okay, Mike from Indiana sent me some feedback. He says, thanks for Airline Pilot Guy number 32. You're welcome, Mike. Listening to the problem with a runway incursion in Boston reminded me of a flight into Washington Reagan Airport on May 20th. We were landing from the south and could not have been more than 4 feet above the ground when the pilot powered up the engines and climbed, banking to the right. My first thought was wondering how freely the Air Force would use anti-aircraft missiles if we were over restricted airspace by the White House or Capitol. We climbed quickly, and the flight attendant was great in getting on the intercom and calming everybody down. After a while, the pilot came on and apologized and said that a plane that was taking off ahead of us proceeded very slowly and was still on the runway, forcing him to abort our landing. We were on Delta Flight 4232, which departed from Indianapolis. I tried to listen on liveatc.net, but could not figure out anything without your guidance. keep up your good work. God bless you. Mike from Indiana. Thanks, Mike. So I went over, before I recorded the show today, I went over to liveatc.net. I actually found the tapes, and what you do, for those of you interested in, you know, if you had a flight recently and you want to listen to some of the ATC tapes of your particular flight or whatever, you're just curious about other people's flights, you can, I thought I had that tab open in my browser. Well, anyway, on the left-hand column, I think it says something like ATC archives, and you click on that, and then it gives you a calendar view, and you click on the day that you're looking for. Now remember that when you're doing your searching, you have to use Z time or coordinated universal time, which is this time of year, Eastern time zone. You would add 4 hours to get what time it is, Zulu, and they have everything bracketed in 1 half-hour segments. So you pick the right half-hour segment to listen to, and then you select what ATC tape or recording you want to listen to. And in this case, I found the KDCA tower and approach control. Now, the problem with these are people, volunteers that do this, and they have scanners set up that scan multiple frequencies. And one of the problems with that is that you know, you could hear a transmission on, let's say, approach control, And then very shortly thereafter, you're hearing a tower transmission or somebody answering a tower transmission, et cetera. So it's kind of all jumbled up, unless it's a dedicated frequency to just approach control or just tower or just ground or whatever. So it's sometimes a little difficult to listen to. And then some archives have better recording quality than others. This one had a lot of static, and it was kind of difficult to hear. But I did hear the pilots coming in on your flight to Washington, D.C., but they did not have the part where they were told to go around. Now, landing at DCA, it's a short runway, and there's a lot of traffic going in and out of there, and they really, you know, push things. And so when you're on final, it's not unusual at all to see an airplane in position for takeoff. And, of course, they're waiting for the airplane that had just landed ahead of them to clear the runway, because a tower can only give or issue clearance for takeoff when the previously landing airplane has cleared the runway. And then as soon as that happens, they tell the airplane in position to take off. And then, of course, you're out there on final hoping that the airplane that's rolling down the runway will be airborne in time for you to touch down. Now, that's the key. If that airplane is still on the runway and has not rotated for takeoff, and you're about to touch down, you cannot legally land, because, as I mentioned on the last show, you really can't have two airplanes using the same runway at the same time, no matter how long the runway is. That's just a rule. So in this case, I guess the guy probably had to wait a while for the previously landing airplane to clear, started the takeoff roll a little bit later than they wanted to, and of course that messed up your flight, Delta Flight 4232, and I'm sure the tower told them to go around. And now this is one of those sticky situations where you have a flight that's taking off on that runway that you're about to land on, and you're about to land, but now you're basically taking off as well. You're in the middle of a go-around. And so now both of you are kind of pointing up, climbing, and you have to kind of be cognizant of where that airplane is and what he is going to be doing, or he or she, they, are going to be turning, taking off to the north, immediately to the left to follow the river. And an option in Washington, in that case, is to turn to the right, again, to avoid the restricted area that's like 12 o'clock and just a few miles. And so that's probably why you felt the airplane banking to the right. And I'm sure that they cleared the restricted area just fine, but they probably circled back around and landed. But I was really hoping to get that audio and play it on today's show, but again, I couldn't. There were little snippets I could get, giving them clearance for the approach. They were getting vectors, and they got cleared for the Mount Vernon visual approach, runway 1. But I think I actually heard the landing clearance issued, but it was very, very difficult to pick out, and I thought it would have been kind of fatiguing for those of you listening to the show to have to listen to that. So, sorry about that, Mike. But anyway, thanks for the feedback. Keep sending it in. Appreciate it. And then Tim Donnan sent me this to feedback at airlinepilotguy.com. He said, "Hiya, Captain. Further to your feedback discussion on aircraft tires in the most recent episode, I have copied a link to you, a YouTube clip of a U.S. Airways Airbus 330 landing at Manchester, England, filmed by a great contributor of high-quality video, Simon Lowe. A smoother touchdown you may never see, and one I watch at least a couple times a week. Talk about preserving the rubber. Absolutely stunning footage of a beautiful aircraft. I recommend your listeners take a look. Thanks, and keep up the great work. Tim from Australia." And he gave me the link to YouTube. I'll put that in the show notes. And you're absolutely right, Tim. It was a thing of beauty. That airplane came down. He flared just right, held it off perfectly. The back tires and the main gear trucks basically rolled onto the runway. There was no puff of smoke or anything. The front tires and the trucks came down. They had no control over that. They came down pretty rapidly, and there were a little bit of a tire rubber smoke, but otherwise a beautiful landing. The kind of landing that when you get one, you just smile. So take a look at that, folks. That'll be in the show notes. YouTube.com link. And let's see. Finally, let's see if there's anything. Oh, you know, I wanted to do this. Yeah, I have some pet peeves. And now you may notice that when I'm talking on the show, I don't always, sometimes I make mistakes with my grammar. I may mispronounce words and that type of thing, but I don't do it intentionally. And if you hear me do that, send me some feedback and let me know, because I really like to be correct when I pronounce something or when I use English grammar. I'd like to use it the right way. And if I'm doing something wrong, let me know. And I've noticed this is kind of a trend lately, and I'm not sure why this is happening. It might be because we're getting a lot more non-English speakers writing articles. And but for instance, this headline that I saw, two aircrafts crash on Delmarva in a day. Two aircrafts crash. A-I-R-C-R-A-F-T-S. Okay, the plural of aircraft is aircraft. Okay? So you have one aircraft or two aircraft, 10 aircraft. There's no S. Okay, the plural of aircraft, no S. Just like deer. You have one deer, you have two deer, you have five deer, you have 10 deer. Deer is both singular and plural. The other thing, and I know that those of you who have listened to my show have heard me harp on this many, many times, and it's just so hard for me to not say anything about it, but the word is potable, not potable. Okay, it's spelled like, look at the word, P-O-T-A-B-L-E. It's spelled like potato, okay? It doesn't have two T's. It's not P-O-T-T-A-B-L. It's potable. I think it's a French word. And here, if you don't believe me, here's the Merriam-Webster dictionary lady pronouncing it for us.
Potable.
See? Potable. Now, if you can't convince yourself to say potable because you think that everybody's going to think you're mispronouncing it, then just say drinking water. Don't say potable. Okay. And the other one that really bugs me is the misuse, and I'm hearing it more and more, of fewer and less. Yo, I was flying with my, there were less passengers that day. What do you mean there were less passengers? There were fewer passengers. If you can count it, now there are some exceptions, I agree. But generally speaking, if you can count something, the word is fewer, not less. Okay, I'll step down from my soapbox now. And I got that out of my system. Remember, it's potable. Potable. All right, let me look through here the list. I think we got everything that I wanted to talk about. Thank you for those of you who sent in feedback. I think we got it all ways today. We got email feedback, feedback@airlinepilotguy.com. We had a couple of you use my Google. Why do I have so much trouble saying Google? My Google Voice number, which is 30499-PILOT. And we had Armando use the voice recording capability of his iPhone, and he sent that attached as an attachment to feedback@airlinepilotguy.com. And we also had Hillel use the SpeakPipe feature on my website. So thanks to all of you for sending in the feedback. Keep it coming. And let's see. Let me find my closing script here. You too can send feedback to all the aforementioned places. On Facebook, if you want to follow me there, I do have a Facebook page, Airline Pilot Guy, show page. But if you just want to follow the regular stuff that I'm involved with and interactions, it's Captain Jeff. That's facebook.com/CAPT.JEFF. Let's see, on Twitter, I'm Jeff Nielsen, or the Airline Pilot Guy, all one word. And the website, airlinepilotguy.com. And also remember, Stitcher Radio. You can hear the Airline Pilot Guy show there while you're on the go with Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher Smart Radio is on-demand news, talk, and more on your mobile phone and on some cars as well. It's also available on the Sonos sound systems and in-house sound system. Over 5,000 shows on Stitcher. So check out Stitcher.com. You can find that in your favorite app store. And let's see. Okay, that's it. So until we meet again, remember, learn from the mistakes of others. You won't live long enough to make them all yourself. So wishing you unlimited visibility, clear skies, and tailwinds. Take care, and God bless.
This production is affiliated with SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.